here.
Yeah, exactly. I know. It's pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
Nice. So, Randy, I didn't know you were a Marine.
So, are we hot? We're
on. Yeah.
We're live.
So, yep. I don't want to do the whole produce thing. We're just having a conversation.
Oh, perfect.
I think it's the best way like this. Because when we met at the event of Patrick Ben David in December, it was very cool to talk to you at lunch.
I thought we had a great conversation learning about your business and doing development, land development and big deals you have in Canada.
hopefully we can figure them out. But this is loud a little bit, but it's fine. So you were a Marine and you told me that. It's kind of how it brought you to do logistics,
right?
Because explain to me what you do exactly, because I'm not sure.
Well, my main focus is supply chain logistics and teaching that. And how I got into that is I was in the Marine Corps for 20 years, and my last 10 years I was an officer. And as an officer, I was involved in.
So where is the officer rank? How does that work?
So we start out with enlisted. So I enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1989.
Oh, shit.
A while ago. So I enlisted in the Marine Corps, and that was right before the first Gulf War kicked off. Okay. My brother was a Marine, and I joined the Marines, and then the Gulf War kicked off. And then I went in what they call open contract. So I should have been either a grunt or a cook, one of the two.
What are those, the grunt?
A grunt's an infantryman.
Okay.
Right, and a cook is obviously a cook. So, because I had no special skills on my contract, I just took a test that said I was smart enough to fix radios.
How smart do you have to be to fix radios?
There we go. Right, fixing up. So I became a radio repair person. I fixed, and while I was going through radio repair school, they said, "Okay, you're going to be in the Marine Corps."
Oh, that's very important, though.
Yeah, in the Marine Corps.
Because I've read a few books on the Marines, and they were saying. That the radio guy is one of the most important guys on the team, no?
Well, I fixed him. I wasn't a radio operator. Okay. And a radio operator is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So a radio operator is the one that carries the radio that they use to communicate. Because while you're in the middle of nowhere, your lifeline is the radio. That's what calls in the air, calls in support. It tells people what's going on so they can move units around to where you need to be. But I was a radio repair guy, and I fixed what they call microwave equipment, which was big dishes that – shot signals back and forth.
Oh, is that the thing in the movies where they have the small dishes to pick up the?
That's the small one, but I repaired big ones.
Oh, okay.
So that's what I did. And while I was there, and I was in school for a year. Then I went to Okinawa for a year, in Okinawa, Japan. And then while I was in Okinawa, Japan, I became a Marine security guard, an embassy guard. So I served there. Went to Santiago, Chile, to be an embassy guard. So I was protecting embassy personnel in Santiago, Chile. And so
how was that?
That was a great time.
How long were you staying there?
I was there for 12 months, so we're one of 5 to 6 Marines at any one time in a U.S. embassy in a foreign country.
Huh.
So you can imagine, and we're
So there was only 4 or 5 Marines.
5 to 6.
5 to 6.
5 to 6 Marines in.
In the whole thing, in the whole.
In Marines. The whole embassy. In the embassy right there in Santiago, Chile.
Hmm.
So you can imagine we were all young men. In a
having
foreign
fun,
country,
that was cool.
Working for the embassy, so we're like at the State Department level working there, and so it was a great, great time. A lot of hard work. We basically secured the embassy. We served inside and we checked IDs and made sure that people coming in were supposed to be there. And if ever there was any reason to defend the embassy, we would be the ones that would defend it.
Did that happen once?
We had a couple fires that we had to go in and make sure that nobody. No bad guys came into the embassy while they put out the fire. But, it's easy for us as Marines. We're like, that's no big deal because that's what we do. So I was there. And other than that, it was a really, quiet post, for me to do that. And then from there, I applied.
How old were you when you were there, though?
I was 20 years old, 20, 21.
21 years old.
20, 21 years.
And you're in charge of the whole security of the embassy.
No, I'm not. I'm working for the guy that's in charge.
Fool.
So, but there would go down, and you say that, but at night we would be like the only Marine in the embassy, right? We would be the only ones there securing, walking around, making sure there was no classified documents out, make sure that was put away properly, all the doors were locked and all the other good things. Remember Bourne Identity?
Bourne. Yeah.
The first one when he was going in and he... and he beat up the Marines. Well, I was one of those guys that would have got beat up.
Oh, that's.
But luckily, yeah. That didn't happen to you.
Fortunately, no. I didn't. Born did not come through us to
imagine. Imagine how the.
Right. But there are people like that out there, I guess, somewhere, you know. And sure.
And it must be true at some point, no? Because those things must be based on some sort of. Because if we can conceive something, usually it's because somewhere it happens, right?
Right. Somebody has that thought somewhere. There's a person like that somewhere, right?
Then those guys, they must be real in some sort of capacity.
But we would never know it, right?
Exactly. If they're good, then we never know.
if they're doing their job right, we will never know who they are. And then, so while I was at the embassy, I applied for an officer program and got picked up for an officer program where they actually sent me to prep school to get smart. So I was basically did 4 years of high school in 12 months. To teach me math, reading, English reading, chemistry, and all those things before I went to university. And then I went to the University of Florida.
So basically you did all of high school in 12 months.
12 months. That's the way I look at it. I mean, I did my high school. I graduated high school, came in the Marine Corps, but I wasn't smart enough to go to college, you know. But then the Marine Corps said, okay, we think you have some leadership. We're going to go ahead and send you to college. But before we send you, we got to make sure you're smart. So we're going to send you to prep school. So they sent me to prep school.
Oh, that's what prep school is.
Yeah, so it's just basic things. So I got smart, and then I went to the University of Florida, all while still an active duty Marine, earning, you know, full pay and benefits. So now I'm a young man, Marine, at the University of Florida. So
how was that?
That was a good time, too.
Oh, yeah?
That was a real good time. And then I finished my 4 years, or three and a half years, I finished my degree, got my commission as a second lieutenant, and then became what they call an Amtrak officer.
What does that mean, when you get your commission?
So now you have enlisted Marines, or what they call E1s through E9, and they're the worker bees. And then you have the officers who are like the managers. So if you were to think of a business, you would have people that do the work, and then you have the managers, and the officers are the managers, and then the enlisted are the ones that do the work.
Oh, okay.
And in the Marine Corps, we're a little bit different because we tend to be more focused on leadership. So we can have a Lance Corporal who is like an E3 at the bottom of the totem pole.
What's E3?
That would be like a Lance Corporal.
Oh, okay.
So his rank would be E1, E2, and then E9. And then you have officers at another level going up. But a Lance Corporal in the Marine Corps can get a lot of stuff done. They're very capable, very focused on meeting the mission, and they can take, you know, a little bit of nothing and make it into something. It's like when people say, well, there's a 99% chance of failure. A Marine says, so you mean there's a 1% chance of success? And we're like, oh, yeah, okay. We got a shot.
How good can we bet on that 1%, though? Like, how prepared are we to make sure?
It doesn't matter. We're going to find a way, right? We're going to come in.
It's not impossible.
It's not impossible is what you meant.
There's a chance.
There's a chance. There's a small chance. You said there's 1%. We could possibly make this work.
Well, if the payoff is big enough, then maybe 1% chance of success is good. Is good enough chance to.
In the service, is about the payoff is living.
Yeah, exactly.
So is it worth it? Yeah, I think it's worth it. I think we can make it work.
Hmm.
And so then I became an officer, and then I was an Amtrak officer. These are when you see a Marine Corps commercial and you see these vehicles come up out of the ocean, and the Marines come out of the back. You ever seen those?
Yeah.
Usually when you watch the football games. Well, I commanded a platoon of those, 12 of those.
Oh, okay.
So I'd be the lieutenant that would bring all those vehicles up, and the Marines would come out the back, and then they would do their
like the transport via.
That's right. Okay. But we come off a ship onto the beach to do that. So and then from there, I got an opportunity to become a supply officer to do what they call a career broadening.
Is that what you said
tour.
You were on the boat?
That's when I became. Well, the next was a supply officer at the School of Infantry, and it was at that moment I realized nothing happens without a supply chain. Nothing. No Marine can do anything, no infantryman, no operations. Nothing can happen without a supply chain. So I wanted to be part of that, to be involved in that level of planning, that level of detail to ensure an operation could be successful.
How much details, like how much planning do you talk about for what standard operation in the Marines, let's say?
You'll take it from beginning to end. So you'll plan out from the moment you would leave a base, a fire base, all the way to conduct your mission, all the way back. So anything you would need, bullets, first aid equipment, food, chow, water, the equipment that you're going to wear, night vision goggles, radio equipment, batteries, everything you would possibly need for that, you would plan that out. And a supply officer would be responsible for making sure that stuff was available for the units to be able to execute that mission.
Oh, yeah, because you can't be short on one thing when you need to do a mission.
Right. you need batteries, right? So, yeah. I mean, usually the comm's the first thing to go, right? We're talking about the equipment here. The first thing that's going to go wrong is the equipment's not going to work. So you want to make sure you have enough batteries. You want to make sure you have, of course, ammunition to fight a battle when you have to fight the battle. You want to make sure you have that. And what a supply officer does is make sure all that stuff is available for those units to execute and use the things. Because whatever they have is what they have.
And then so even in the Army, you were involved in those strategic planning for supply?
Different levels. So in the Marine Corps, not the Army. Different.
Oh, sorry.
Very different in the military. You'll see, we're brothers, but we're brothers. You know, we kind of, you know, we'll, it's not the same thing.
So the
for
Marine
sure.
says the Army is a pussy.
No, we didn't say that. We all have our different missions, and it's funny you say
Who's the best one though?
The Marine Corps, of course. You know, Marine
well,
Corps.
You
is the
were
best.
One, so it makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. Well, what's interesting is I was doing my retirement speech in 2010. Was that I did an analysis, and less than 0.01% of the population actually serves today. So anyone that's in any service, whether it be the Army, Marine Corps, Navy, Air Force, any of those services, it really says a lot about their character when they step to become part of that. Because everything that happened after 9/11, everybody that joined at that point forward, even till now, knew they were going to war. It wasn't like I'm going for the education, I'm not going for the experience or the travel. They knew they were going to war.
Yeah.
So the fact that anyone volunteers, even today, people that volunteer for the service, they even if they don't make it through boot camp. Let's just say they stepped up, you know, they stepped up willing to do something. And because you know, when you're in the service, you're just 24/7, 365.
Yeah, because it's hard to be a Marine, to become a Marine even. It's very hard, no?
It is, you know, but it's what you do. Nobody becomes a Marine for the education or the money, that's for sure. Most of us are a little bit touched in the head, you know. Again,
a lot of Texans for some reason.
Right, just a little bit there, you know. But we know we're there for the challenge. We're there for the hard work. We're there to be Marines. That's what you go. That's why you join the Marine Corps.
Are you from Florida or were you born here?
No, I was born in Atlanta, Georgia. And then I moved a lot as I was a kid. My dad just moved a lot with his job.
What did he do?
He was he was in corporate America. He was in pest control, so that's what he did.
And for Monsanto or some
like Terminex, Orkin, these pest control companies, these large companies. That's what he worked, and he would be like a big manager that would go in and fix different branches. We moved a lot to do that.
Huh. Well, I guess it's a big market.
Yeah. Pest control, everyone needs, and they call it pest control and not pest elimination. So there's always a market for bugs. Yeah. It's always a market to kill some bugs,
yeah, I bet.
But that moving, I think, you know, helped shape my ability to do things and to go out and, you know, just to have different experiences.
Able to adapt.
Like, adapt easily. In different areas. And
I guess you kind of saw, like, what you need to move somewhere, too.
Yep. I don't know. I wasn't really paying attention to that when I was that guy.
Subconsciously, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So then I became a supply officer. While I was in that tour as a supply officer, I got my master's and I actually got my doctorate in business, international business.
Nice.
For that, then I went back to the fleet and operations, and I was a logistics officer for Marine Expeditionary Unit. So while I was an Amtrak officer, I deployed into the Mediterranean, and there was really nothing going on. We were just, you know, on a ship. And what a MEU is, a Marine Expeditionary Unit, we are pre-positioned forces forward for the president to use at his will to enforce the policies of the United States.
Hmm.
So whenever there's an embassy evacuation. You've heard of, there was a recently, I forget which one it was. There was an embassy that was evacuated because the country was just collapsing. The Marine Expeditionary Unit would go and evacuate that embassy. They would show up with a ship, helicopters, Marines. They would go in, they would get everyone out. If there's a natural disaster, like a tsunami or an earthquake or a volcano or anything like that, and there's, you know, they need people on the ground to take control of the chaos and put order in the ground to make sure people got, you know, water, food. The Marine Expeditionary Units are the first ones to show up to make sure that all that happens. And so I did that as a lieutenant, and then as a captain, I did that as well. But I was a logistics officer this time. with the Marine Expeditionary Unit, 26th Combat Logistics Battalion at the time. And so, and that was, the idea was all the MUs were going into Iraq. Like, it was just another unit, just another way to go in there. But we ended up not going in there. So when we came through the Red Sea, we hung a right instead of a left. And so we did work off the east coast of Africa. We were doing pirate interdiction before pirate interdiction was known to be going on. The Navy was out there flying drones and looking for pirates and doing that kind of stuff. And so we were out there doing that.
I never thought there was still going to be pirates.
Yeah.
Now.
They're all over the world. They're even in the Caribbean, so I don't think. Whenever you decide to take a sailing cruise in the Caribbean, beware. They're out there. You know, so yeah.
Is that common, though, like pirate attacks on ships?
Mm-hmm. Especially in Africa, off the east coast of Africa, in that area, and then also in the the Pacific, in the West Pacific, across Malaysia, Philippines. There's a lot of pirates in those areas as well. Yeah.
And then they steal the merchandise and then they resell it.
They take the boat, they ransom, steal stuff, you know. I mean, yeah, the scheme we hear about now on the news is they'll take the oil tanker and they'll hold it hostage for the oil. They'll say you need to pay $1 million or however many millions of dollars to get the oil back.
So basically now they're brokering the boat.
Right. They just take control of it and, you know, they take control of it. And it doesn't take much because there's not very many people on a boat. And most of those people aren't armed, nor do they have any knowledge of how to defend against pirates coming on.
But it kind of makes sense, though, because it seems like all through history there was always pirates in every distribution routes. Even in the Middle East, when there was the reason why the Spain launched an expedition to North America, because they wanted to figure out the route to India.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right. Yeah.
And then they were getting attacked through the Middle East.
Correct. Yeah. And then they found this other country in the middle of that, called North America.
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah. So then from there, I went to become an acquisition officer, which is where we manage different programs in the Marine Corps, and we managed.
So you're managing the buying and the buying.
The buying and the selling, or not the selling, but the buying of stuff for the Marine Corps.
Oh, procurement.
Procurement, exactly. Procurement. So that's what, you know, a lot of people, when they think supply chain, they think procurement, but there's just more to it. Yeah. And when I think supply chain, is from raw materials all the way through customer service. So everything it takes to make the stuff, how you make the stuff, how you put the stuff together, how you deliver the stuff to the customer, that's the supply chain.
And then so basically now your expertise is procurement on supply chain.
Now it's all parts of the supply chain, logistics, procurement, contract management, leadership and
start
development.
Cool.
Everything.
Okay, so
everything
vertically integrated for all of it.
Correct. So that's what I train people on. So when I came out of the service, nobody would hire me, believe it or not. I had a doctorate, 20 years in the service, and nobody would hire me.
Why?
So I started my own company, probably because I just had too many credentials.
Yeah, I think that's actually a pretty common theme, unfortunately, with
lot
of people that come out of any division of military, I guess.
Any of the services, the full service. And actually, that's one of the things we're doing now with SCM.jobs, which is the career development side. You know, SCM.jobs or supply chain management.jobs, is we're focusing on military people to build their skills in supply chain, procurement, purchasing, all the different areas of supply chain. And then our platform is focused on helping them find positions. And we're just starting that now. So we're building the platform. We have the training piece to help them learn the skills. We're putting the platform together so they can post their resumes and people can find their resumes. And then the next level, which will be later on this year, we'll actually start placing people. Well, no military
so
people are coming out.
Next year, you're going to start placing people?
My goal is by the end of this year
by
to start
the end
placing
of this
people.
This year, okay. And then what's the timeline on the whole thing? Where are you at in the process of doing that? Because it's interesting.
Right. We're building the platform. We're getting the back office all kind of set. How do we find our leads? How do we do our sales process? How do we close the leads for the recruiting side, for job posts and that?
I may have people I can refer you that could help with those.
Okay.
Yeah,
definitely. Because we're putting this all together, and the idea really is so that people coming out of the military, they all have skills in supply chain, whether it's a E3 planning a patrol, because he's got to take care of his team of 2 to 3 Marines.
Right.
He's got to plan all the logistics for that. And then you have a squad leader to a lieutenant who has, you know, squad leader has a squad of 12 Marines. A lieutenant has a platoon of 4 squads, so he's in charge of 48 Marines, and then a company commander and so forth up the rank. They all have supply chain planning skills that can be used for businesses. And what I'm, what's interesting is I've been to a couple conferences and I'm talking to people that there's really a struggle to find qualified people that understand procurement to be able to do these jobs in these businesses.
Yeah, because I saw one of the stats on your website. You were saying that only 15% of CEOs are confident about their supply chain integration.
Correct.
That's fucking wild.
Isn't it? Yeah, and we saw that when during the pandemic, right?
Holy
we saw
shit.
That. It was all big
I
issue.
To learn. Yeah, how everybody Holy ran into issues at the ports. And,
right?
Yeah, 15%.
Right. And now 85% or 87% is a new study that came out in 2022 with, I think it was Deloitte that put it out, that said that CEOs realize supply chain's an issue, but they're throwing technology at it. They're like, I'm going to fix this with computers and software and AI.
But at the end, we always want to replace us with the tools that we're building. It's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, but even then, people have to make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You can have all the data in the world, all the tools telling you what's going on.
The hammer never hammered the fucking nails alone.
Correct.
It's the same with
That's a great analogy.
Yes, it's the
Put
same
the nail
thing.
On the hammer.
They're not going to do anything.
Somebody's got to pick up the hammer. Somebody's got to put the nail in the right place and knock it in.
Yeah, because
right?
sometimes you fucking hit your thumb and that's painful as
hell. Right?
Holy shit.
Yeah. So that's part of the whole, what my vision for the future is to build a platform that really just enables supply chain.
But it's nice that you want to do it through helping vets too.
Correct.
Because I think there's, especially looking at you now, nobody wanted to hire you. This is fucking ludicrous.
It was a shock to me, but it was reality.
Then think about how much the potential the potential value of everyone that are not working at the right position is lost. How much? Mm-hmm. Think about all of the lost in potentials.
I think the biggest reason people don't hire vets is because they don't see the business value of a veteran from a business point of view. And veterans are not very good at articulating our value in a business way for them to understand.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Because I haven't been in that setting, but you've got people that have real world street smarts and experience. Right. And it is, I'm obviously a big supporter, and I think that military is a perfect route to go to bring people into operations and procurement, all of that, because of all the experience that they've had in the real world.
It makes
so much sense.
And what I think one of the biggest reasons military will do well is because they bring calm to chaos.
That too.
So,
because
when a supply chain breaks, that's when people
panic. They do the wrong things.
They start making bad decisions because they don't have the stuff to do their job and timelines are pushing.
What's an example of a bad decision you can make? Like when
hundreds of boats are lining up at the port and there's stuff's piling up. Nobody, and it's just costing more money. And you don't know.
So that's why the boats are piling up in Fort Lauderdale.
It could be. Yeah.
I don't know.
They can't get them unloaded fast enough.
Have you noticed sometimes there's a few boats, a few cargo boats right in front of the beach on Las Olas?
I think that's common.
Someone I think told me that it was common, but I was intrigued. I was like, it can't be. I don't know how long it is to unload those boats, but maybe
there's a lot of them.
There's
an awful lot of them, and what you're seeing is a backup in the supply chain. So all the stuff that was ordered but not delivered during the pandemic, right? And now because of deglobalization, where they're bringing manufacturing back, there's a process that they have to go through. They have to build up inventory here in order to then transition manufacturing footprint here.
Do you think it's gonna have a big effect on the port of Miami? Because that port is, I think, is the one of the largest exporter in the world.
Miami is one of the largest ports in the world, absolutely.
I think it's number five.
And the limiting factors for ships is the super cruisers, which are gigantic.
What
and
are
they,
those?
These are
the big, huge boats.
They're huge boats that have a deep. When they're loaded, they're deep. So these ports aren't all built for these bigger ships. Because they're huge. They're not old. They're just gigantic.
No,
so,
but is it because the port was built a long time ago?
It was built for those ships at that time.
Right.
The largest ships at that time.
And now we build bigger
ships. And now the ships get bigger and bigger. And that's what we were talking before about the railroad and the Panama Canal. The Panama Canal cannot handle the large ships now. That's why they want to restructure the Panama Canal. And I think it's a really smart thing with the rail thing, because now you just got to bring the ships there.
Well, yeah, and the cool thing is we believe, because I was saying to you that one of my best friend lives in that area. Now he moved. I think a year and a half ago. And he's doing real estate development over there.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah.
So he started to do development for houses, triplex, small project, but he was selling to foreign investors.
Makes sense.
Because the price that you have there compared to what we can have here, you can have a very nice house for $250, $350, something like that. Very not expensive compared to most places.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in the U.S. Very
cool. Yeah, and right. Then there's a lot of money over there too. So he brought to me the opportunity to maybe do the development over there.
Oh, good.
Because of the railroad, and then now we're trying to assemble this. And then I think because another of my friend referred him a guy that specializes in line assembly for warehouses. Mm-hmm. So we think we're going to, in like a year, maybe two, we think we're going to be able to be fully integrated to to be able to deliver turnkey warehouses for people that would like to transfer their manufacturing from China to Mexico.
Perfect. Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a definite, and that's exactly what needs to happen. You got to build the storage space. And what a lot of folks, when it comes to supply chain, the biggest limiting factor is time.
Yeah,
everything
exactly.
Takes time. Everything takes time to build these warehouses, to put the infrastructure in place, to build a railroad, to move manufacturing from China to the United States. That all takes time.
Yeah, because he's doing a project now. If everything goes well, in like 9 to 12 months, it's going to be done. And then now we could potentially repeat because we have financing in place.
Well, perfect. Yeah. I would definitely say there's a market.
There's a huge market for this.
Right.
Oh, could you imagine?
And that's where the supply chain professional comes into play.
Exactly.
You know, because they're thinking. You know, there's strategic conversations to have about where do you put that warehouse? Do you build that warehouse wide, or do you build it tall, or do you build it wide and tall? What kind of cargo are you going to put in there?
Well, then soon enough, what we see in industrial property for the newer built is very high ceiling, mm-hmm. because then square footage has become very expensive with the price of the land that has become super expensive. Because not so long ago, you could buy industrial land for a few bucks a foot. Now, someplace it's like 50.
Wow!
Oh yeah,
big jump.
Holy shit.
So, and part of that design should be thoughts of robotics. How are you going to integrate AI exactly. to make
so
that
this
smarter?
This is why the guys want super high warehouses, because then on the volume, the square footage is not that bad.
Right.
And then you can have racking, and then you can put robots into the racking that does all of that. Yeah.
Do a lot of the work.
So then this is why the new build, the big value, maybe the commercial lease at some point are going to be charge on the volume instead of the square footage. At some point, somebody is going to figure out that maybe they're losing money.
Well, we had one of the classes I was training had a woman who I call her. I think she was one of the best negotiators I ever heard a story from, because
really,
there's a company like Grainger. You know Grainger?
No.
Grainger is a company, a lot of hardware stuff.
Hardware.
Any gadget you need, Grainger has it.
Okay.
So and
it's like Canadian Tire for us.
Yeah. And so and what they wanted to do was put vending machines inside this warehouse for the gear that they needed, right? And what it is basically what you do is each person has a card that they go and they swipe and they get the stuff that they need.
Boy, so they were vending machines for tools.
Tools for safety equipment, expendables, office stuff, you know, that kind of thing. So you put a vending machine there.
Did that work?
Absolutely, it works.
Really?
They save like $30,000 to $50,000 the first year that they put it in, because people had to sign for it. They could no longer just take it and say, "Oh, I'm using it." They were actually accountable for, because every time they swiped that card, it would track it to that person. And so you can look at the usage and say, "Okay, this is great." You know, they took 100 widgets. Mary took 100 widgets. Why does Mary need 100 widgets? And they would go talk to Mary or John or whoever was taking 100 widgets, so people wouldn't want that conversation, so they wouldn't steal. It stopped a lot of stealing.
Huh, okay.
But now, why was she the best negotiator? The reason she was the best negotiator is because she made Grainger pay for the square footage of the vending machine for them to put that vending machine in her warehouse. She was like, oh, no, no, no. You're going to pay for that. We're paying you for the stuff. You're going to pay us for the space.
Nice.
That's what I said. I said, that's nice. Really smart. That goes to your point of, you know, nice. Square footage meaning something.
Yeah, because just think about it, because the value of your commercial real estate is based on the revenue per square footage that you're going to regenerate on those. So then that small things, maybe, I don't know how big they lease the thing, but it can make at $30, $40 net a foot, it can make a big dent on the value sometimes. Sometimes you can, with stupid things like that, you can have hundreds of thousands of dollars, sometimes millions of dollars on top of your building values. And then when the cool thing about investing in real estate is because then you can refinance and take out the money.
Right.
so because it's debt, it's not taxable, and then you reinvest in something else.
And that's where the supply chain professional, I call them the supply chain professional, even though procurement's one of the functions within supply chain, the supply chain professional understands the bigger picture, right? They understand that square footage has value. They understand that there's an impact when oil prices go up, there's an impact on delivery charges, it's going to raise the prices. So they're trying to lock in prices. There's a story of we had someone from waste management in our training program, and he said I could tell this story. And what they saw, through their analysis, they saw that the price of tires was going to increase because the price of rubber was going to increase. So they locked in a two-year contract with the tire manufacturer to lock in prices. So as prices were going up.
That's called edging, right?
Hedging.
Yes.
Yeah. So as prices were going up, their waste management, all the garbage trucks you see driving around, that's what we're talking about. Their tires prices were staying the same for 2 years. Before they got caught up. So, again, that's where a supply chain professional sees the big picture and can find those opportunities. But we're going to talk about, you know, throwing software at these problems, but they're not throwing training at the people who would operate and use the software to make it work.
You're better off being more informed and have dumber technology than the opposite, no?
I think it's the better your the technology is only as good as you can use it.
Right.
Because if you gave me, for example, you gave me a Ferrari, I would drive it at 25 miles an hour. Well, because I don't know how to drive a Ferrari the way a Ferrari should be driven, right? And kind of the analogy goes to these systems and the software. AI is going to be able to pull a lot of data and give you a lot of signals. But if you don't know what to do with that data and you don't know how to interpret those signals, it's just a waste of money.
Exactly.
Yeah, garbage in, garbage out.
Garbage in, garbage out. You know, that's exactly
and
right.
And also, it's the AI, what I'm finding, because we've been playing with it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And because one of my friend, Karen, we did a podcast with her a few weeks ago, and she's an AI consultant on how to integrate ChatGPT into operation. And the claims that she's made that she made and the result that she's having in the reducing cost is fucking wild.
It is.
Like 30% at least.
At least. No doubt.
Yeah.
Without knowing the case study, I would believe that.
And then so because most of the saving of time is when you can use it. So you can train part of ChatGPT, they're called GPTs, so you can train them into doing a specific task. And then so basically, because at first it's going to make mistakes, but then when you train them, so basically you correct the mistake, you work on the thing, you analyze more data, and then so you can perfect those.
Right.
And then to produce report, to produce like ideas or to reformulate ideas or to analyze data is fucking amazing. It's very, very cool. I had to summarize because. With some partners, we have an investing funds that we're launching soon.
Okay. Yeah, you told me about that. Yeah.
Yeah, and now we're about ready, but we need to do the chart of the business because I want to model the firm based on Ray Dalio's Bridgewater.
Okay.
Because I read his book Principle and I loved it. And I want to apply those principles to my business because I thought they were very, very sound. The first one is radical transparency, and then followed by radical openness, because I don't think you can work with partners if you're not completely open and you don't agree on where the business should go. Right. Because at the end of the day, if you don't, if you make decision for you over the business, then it's going to fail.
I agree with that. You know, for any organization,
and it's, I bet it was the same thing in the Marines too. The teams first.
We would say team. We would use what they call commander's guidance and vision, is what, you know, in the corporate world we call it vision and mission, and yeah. in the Marine Corps military world we call it commander's guidance.
Well, in football, which is their vision. The same thing.
Yeah.
Team is first.
Yeah, but you got to have a leader that has a vision.
Yeah,
and then anyone that joins a team has to align with and agree with that vision. And I think that's where open transparency and openness is critical. It's like if you come to the table, you buy into this mission.
Yeah.
If you don't buy into this mission, go away from the table.
Yeah.
Because we're all going to talk about it, and if we all have the same goal, the assumption is we're all going to do what's best to accomplish that goal.
Exactly. Exactly. So basically, I liked the book, and I did a very decent presentation on the structure of the book, all of the principle, how they apply to the business. It took me less than 30 minutes.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
And the simple, the best things are the simple things, aren't they?
I know.
So it was. You don't have to make it complicated.
Exactly. So I sent the thread to my partner in operation that we're structuring the thing with. And I was like, "Well, review this before our meeting, and then we can discuss."
Awesome.
Yeah, it would have taken me a week probably to go through all of the book and then organize everything and then how it applies. It's for me at least, massive job. Whew.
So you're saying the AI did this for you?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
Because. I kind of talk with the AI, mm-hmm. like it's a person.
I use it all the time.
Yeah.
I use it all the time.
Yeah.
I use it for marketing, build buyer personas. It's really mm-hmm. interesting there. And then you can ask it questions to think like the buyer you want to target.
Yeah, because really if you fun. Notice that the more you give perspective to your input, the more refined the answer is going to be.
And that, I think that's the benefit and also the disadvantage of AI. It's only as smart as it was trained to do.
It's only as smart as you, maybe.
And that's where a person, and bringing it back down to the supply chain, where a lot of them could be replaced by AI to do a lot of the rudimentary or redundant tasks like purchase orders. But how do you know when it's wrong? How do you know when the AI is wrong? You got to have a human that has the knowledge and the experience to say that doesn't make sense.
Because it is wrong.
It is wrong.
It is wrong sometimes. I mean, it does make mistakes.
Absolutely, all the time.
Yeah, I had that
all
happen the time today, actually.
Did you?
And I was
yeah.
like, I pushed it and questioned it, and I asked, how did you come to this conclusion? And it took a couple tries to understand why, and then eventually it actually apologized. And
oh, yeah?
Yeah, and that's the first time I've had that, but it's only because I double-checked
right.
what it was producing. I'm
well,
like,
have you seen what
right.
happened with Google Gemini?
I did.
Holy shit!
Oops. Actually, I tried to get a couple of graphics from Gemini, because you can do the advanced Gemini. You can pay for the subscription, and then that'll do, like, graphics for you. So I said,
well, have
hey.
You seen the one of the founding fathers?
I saw that, right? I was like, well, that's not right. Yeah, well, you know, that's maybe not right. But how would you know if it's not right unless you knew it was not right? If somebody said, I need a picture of the founding fathers, and it spit it out, and you didn't know any better.
At right. some, yeah, exactly.
You would accept it, right? So you have to know better than the AI. And that's where I think humans still have a play in this.
Did you see they lost $70 billion in market value, though?
Who did?
Google.
Because
yeah.
of that?
Yeah.
Oh, well. I think they'll make it back.
Well, I think they should lose more of them.
They will.
Tank this thing, and then if it fails, then sell parts and restructure.
But there's so many of these AI things going on, right? There's so many different ones. You got ChatGPT, you've got Claude, you've got now Gemini, you've got Proximity.
What's Claude and what's Proximity?
These are different, similar platforms to ChatGPT.
Okay.
They interact differently. They,
which
they,
one you like best?
So far, Claude has been the most creative.
Okay.
Then the most realistic, but ChatGPT, OpenAI seems to be the most consistent. So.
I like to work with OpenAI with ChatGPT too.
Same, but I haven't worked with Claude.
Yeah, I'm trying them all right now,
yeah.
And I even like I rogered up to the Google Gemini just to say, I'm gonna, well,
Why not?
And always pay. I always pay the $20, right? It's the $20.
Yeah. No, but with ChatGPT 4 versus 3.5, it makes a big difference.
Absolutely.
It makes a big difference because you cannot analyze documents with the 3.5.
Right.
With 4, you can analyze documents.
You can put a big attachment in there, and it'll look at it, and it'll chew it up and give you something, which
is really
interesting.
You have to be very careful with how you phrase and how you ask if the document is big, because I tried to analyze Miami's industrial report for a meeting that I had with industrial developers, and it didn't do a good job.
Oh, no. Yeah, and that's...
Because there was too much data, so the input that I would have to do to for it to analyze 75 page of data, which it was way too big for. It was easier for me to just look at the fucking report.
Right, but that process you go through in your mind, how do you write those instructions so then the next time AI can do it for you?
Yeah,
is write down your process, and I think that's where again the professional has to know the process and know what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah.
To make it all work. One thing I did find with Claude is very sensitive. Huh. That if you ask it sensitive questions, like I try to do a buyer persona, tell me more about military transitioning people, what their thought process is, and it comes back and says, I don't think it's right to give you personality information. And I was like, oh, really? We'll do it anyway. Like, no. Okay, ChatGPT. So I don't have time to argue with AI.
Not the person I want to work with.
But it was very sensitive. I was like, I didn't know that it could.
Interesting.
It was interesting. Like, wow, I didn't think it would be so sensitive. You're a robot. Do what I tell you. You know.
But somebody designed it.
Because,
when you say creative, what did you mean by when you said it was creative?
Which one?
Claude.
Because it came up with that kind of, the wording was more, because I've written books and papers and blog articles using ChatGPT, Claude, and Bard.
Which one did best?
Gemini. Claude was the one that gave me the most realistic type of content. Because when you write with ChatGPT, it will give you doctorate level type
outputs. You can ask it to
dumb it down.
I asked it to be more down to earth.
Right.
So I guess that maybe that's what Claude is a bit like.
Because then with ChatGPT, you can convey emotions into the thing too.
But like you said, you got to tell it, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You got to tell it.
Yeah. I actually the other day I like to write it as if it was a friend that I talked to. I think it's nice because then you can ask question and you can explain your point of view and then so it's kind of cool. I kind of analyzed emotions I describe how how I felt and because of what and this and that, and it gave me like a very interesting answer on how it was kind of connected.
It is, yeah. I'm getting there, talking to it like a friend instead of like a junkyard
like
dog.
Like a thing. and did you know that you get better answer if you say please and thank you?
Yep, please and thank you, and you're nice
wild.
To it. It's like, oh.
It's wild. What we're going to do with quantum computing, because that's the follow-up on this. That's where the technology is going to go. And then that is kind of, because I'm reading, do you know who Michio Kaku is?
No, I don't.
Okay, so he's a scientist, like a big one.
a mad scientist, like the hair coming out.
Kind of, yes. The guy was building a particle accelerator in his room when he was 17 years old.
Good for him.
I was not doing that when I was 17.
No, I wasn't either.
Right. No, yeah, and so he works on quantum computing now, and I'm reading his book because I heard of him. He was on Rogan twice.
Okay.
And the first time was fascinating because he was talking about the levels of civilization.
Okay.
Are you aware of this concept?
I'm not.
Okay. So how it works is with GDP, right? Mm-hmm. You can and then you have historical GDP growth, and then you can extrapolate to projection for historical growth, right?
Makes sense.
So you can project where it's going to be in 100 years, 200 years, 1,000 of years, whatever. And then so you can also deduct the amount of energy that you need to kind of control the element of Earth, go in space and go like in galaxies or whatever. So he was saying that now we're at 0.07 level.
0.07. Wow.
Okay, no, 0.7. So 70%.
Okay.
Okay. And then at one, so basically when we're at one, so it's projected to be, I think, in 2100 or something like that. But maybe I'm wrong on the dates. I don't know. But apparently when we're produce this level of energy, then we can control, we can have control on the planetary level.
Okay.
So then meaning we could, so because climate and things like that, it's kind of like how the Earth is rotating because of the sun, right? I think that's how it works. Mm-hmm. And then so apparently if we can have this amount of the energy, we could control Earth.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then level two is kind of Star Trek. So okay. Star Trek would be civilization level two.
That'd be great.
And then level three is the Empire in Star Wars.
Okay.
And
have you ever wondered where they come up with the material to build the Death Star? Where did that metal come from? Where did that?
What's the metal? What is the material?
Well, then
I don't know what the material is. It's like it's a big ball with stuff in it.
But think about how much resources a meteor has.
Mm-hmm.
Those are like big rocks,
right?
With they're filled with minerals.
Mm-hmm.
This is basically what it is. So if we can figure out to do space mining, then we can fucking have the resources to do all of that.
There's some real estate development.
There's a big one.
right there. That would be interesting. That's really interesting. How do we get up there? I guess that's why we're launching, because I live right near Cape Canaveral. That's why
Musk is, I think, is so interested in going to Mars.
Yeah, they're like launching a rocket every day now. Every day.
Out of Cape Canaveral.
Cape Canaveral.
It is really cool. That's right there.
Well, in his book, he was saying, in his old book, I think like a few years ago, he was saying that SpaceX was shooting rockets for at least, for I think, one-tenth of the cost that NASA was doing. Or some crazy amount like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he can't hide all the other costs into it.
Private sector between
capitalism at its greatest. It's efficiency.
How do we not even realize that? Why are we asking the government to handle anything?
That's a great question. That's a really good question. And I think part of it is the government has the bureaucracy to keep it all kind of all wrapped up.
Yeah, but they should act as a GC more than actually doing the work. Like the general is not going to do the work in the army.
I think there's just too many. There's a lot of money at the upper levels, right? You know, all the money going to foreign aid. It's like, well, how much does that actually make it in regards to foreign aid?
Yeah.
You know, how much of that actually gets on the ground and to do this? And Somalia is a great example. When they were going to Somalia, they were sending, the UN was sending a lot of food aid to Somalia to help the starvation and that was going on there. And the warlords would take control of that and own it and keep control of it to control the population. And that's kind of a small example of the bigger picture of why is government can control it to control the population, right?
Well, yeah, of course. The Castro in Cuba was not missing any meal.
No kidding. Right?
Absolutely. No, but it's true. Like when people are in power, if they have the absolute power, then all of the resources are staying at the top level, and then the population starves, basically.
It can, and that's where you need leadership at all levels to do leadership, And then and that's kind of the bigger problem throughout the world and other countries. I think that's one of the things that here in the United States we have to be aware of is power of the people for our government. How is that really going?
We were talking about the chip manufacturing earlier.
We were, yeah.
Where do you see that going?
Because
you said that what's the country?
Taiwan.
Making 90% of the chip.
90% of the chips.
And you said that all of the supplier, if one fails, everything fails.
I heard this from Peter Zeihan. He's a great geopoliticist, and he talks a lot about the economy and. And he really brings the economic picture to a lot of the political stuff you see in the media. Like, what's the real reason? What's the real story? And that's where, he's like, the question was, do we really need to worry about Taiwan? And he's like, there's like 9,000 different companies involved in making chips. And if any one fails, the entire chip process falls apart. So it's like, okay. So, yeah, China can take Taiwan. But if any company decides not to play, China doesn't have, China only has Taiwan. They don't have that big impact.
They don't have the industry.
They don't have the industry.
And it's hard to control 9,000 people at the same
time. Yeah. 9,000 businesses, right?
9,000 businesses, right? Yeah. But at the end of the day, you need to control like the top guys or whatever, but or someone that is controlling so in some sort, in some way, the business. Or, well, you can, you could also control regulations and things.
Yeah,
like
I was
going
to say, probably just put some sort of regulation in place, and then everybody has to abide by it. That could be it.
Well, it's, well, you bring up an interesting point in that
if they want to do business,
but it's hard though because it doesn't like it doesn't happen all at once. Because so, regulation, there's a rules is there, and then people are gonna still gonna do what the what they're doing, and then at some point they're gonna get fined or some. But you need force to
enforcement,
enforce.
Yeah.
You need enforcement.
That's what I was gonna say. Laws are great for people that follow laws, but when you don't follow the laws, what do you have?
Well, yeah, and then you the know? Enforcement that you have ultimately is violence, and with the army and the police. This is why
right.
having guns here is so important. Well, it keeps them in check.
Yeah, I think we a lot of people have seen real. There's a, I think, you know, with the gun control, that conversation is shifting and changing as they saw what happened in Israel and the value of having the ability to protect yourself.
Well, with the yeah. with the 8 million people that came in illegally, have you heard that some people are saying that there could be some dormant cells in those?
That could, and that's always a risk. That's always a risk. And that's why we as
well, we know there's terrorists in mm-hmm. in them.
And they're building, and you know they're always, you know, Big Brother's watching and listening. You know, social media is always tracking. People have to communicate. You know, and even then they go down to the level of being able to track key ingredients to make things that go boom. There's key ingredients that make those things go boom. If you don't have that ingredient, it doesn't work. So they track that active ingredient. You know, like we were talking about before. You know, if you don't have that one ingredient, so they can watch and track that. And
did you pay attention to that at all? Like the flow of migrant, where it comes from, how it works, things like that.
What do you mean?
Well, because it's the route is organized, right?
A lot of from what I hear is you know they come to Mexico, they get on a bus up to the border and they cross. They just know where to go.
Well, what I've heard is they come through I think Ecuador. First time, because I think there's no visa requirement to enter Ecuador, and then they go through some sort of jungle for I think for 60 miles close to the Panama Canal in Central okay. America, and apparently this one is very dangerous. There's a lot of people that dies on the route. Then they have to take a train. Then they get robbed. I've heard that there's a lot of people that get rapes in the train, but then they still. They're still doing all of the walk mm-hmm. to come here because they've been told that they could do it.
Now's the time.
They're letting people in.
Now's the time. Now you want
to
come.
You just have to vote Democrat. You're gonna have the credit card, and then you're gonna be good to go.
Yeah. You know, we'll see. You know, still the United States is still better. They're coming to something better, right?
Well,
wherever
yeah.
they are, they think. Life in the United States is going to be better. So they're willing to do that, go through that arduous experience
to get there.
You
can't blame them.
Yeah.
Because I would probably do the same thing, too.
And why not? You know, if your life in, you know, look at these third world countries, their life, you know, they live on $2 a day and a handful of beans.
Yeah.
They come here and they're willing to bust their butts. They can be an Uber driver and make a whole lot more, you know.
The problem is that it should be... I don't know. It should be faster to legally immigrate, maybe.
We'll see. You know, that's where I think the government could do something. They could legalize the process. They could put a process in place and make it all work if they wanted to.
Boy, they don't want to because, have you seen I saw a bunch of videos of people talking to the migrants, and they would ask who they would vote to, and then they all said Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Because... Okay. Because then, well, maybe, so I've heard that they liked this to continue because then they're betting on the fact that they're maybe manufacturing some new voters.
Maybe. So if we think about the population of the United States, what, 300 million people?
Yeah.
They're about 300 million people. And how many people actually voted in the last election? On both sides. I think Biden said he got 80 million.
160, something like that.
Right. So... There's still 140 million
That's
left.
True.
Then we add 12 million to that. You know, then if those 12 million actually vote, will they vote? Right. And then you can't find another 12 million on the other side to counter that vote. Mm. Yeah. I mean, think about how many people don't vote and really sad, you know, here in the United States, we have that opportunity to vote and
that's
don't.
That's a problem too.
You know, it should be a national holiday. You will vote, and that's your citizen.
I agree with you on this one. It should be a national holiday, and then you just have to do that. Then
you should get a ticket if you don't vote. You should get fined if you don't vote. You didn't vote.
Well, what do you think about? That's interesting too. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But we were talking about Taiwan. I want to go deeper on this one.
So I think the concern is that we're going to lose the chip manufacturing footprint. So why
is that important?
The reason is because everything has chips. Every car you buy today has a chip in it, and very dependent upon microchips for everything. And everything in here, everything we're talking, phones, watches, everything has a microchip in it of some form.
That one, all of the phones, the cameras.
Yeah, in this room easily maybe 10 chips at least.
Right. Well, more than that.
More than that.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Well, probably
2, 4, 50. Oh, 6 mic. Yeah, I don't
know. Easy. 50. These are all chips. The lights are chips. Everything's chips. So that's why it's important that to understand the microchips. And the more the supply chain behind it is that Taiwan is the manufacturing footprint, but they don't own the intellectual property.
Who owns the intellectual property?
The companies own the intellectual property. Okay. And they are mainly out of the United States. So the United States own the intellectual property, but they manufacture the chips in Taiwan. Okay. Hmm. And there's been last year... One of the good things the Biden administration has done is they enacted, I forget the name of the act, but basically they gave like $10 billion to bring chip manufacturing back to the United States. They're setting up plants in Arizona and Texas, and I think those are the two main areas. But it takes time. Again, it takes time to build.
Well, yeah, because it takes a lot of time to build those manufacturing plants.
And I think the benefit of now building it now, they're going to be able to build it with the latest, greatest technology to better produce chips that are even more advanced than what they're getting out of Taiwan. But again, everything takes time. And I say it takes time, but at the same time, if we had to build it in 6 weeks, we could build it in 6 weeks if we had to, just because all those resources would just collapse onto it, you know, crashing a project. You know, it's like building, right?
Well, that's the kind of the...
We didn't have to worry about permits. We could get anything done quick, right?
Did you see there's a famous meme of a road that collapsed in Japan or something like that. They repaired it in 2 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The whole thing.
Yeah. Well, they used to have a house special where they would build an entire house in 24 hours. They would knock it down and they would rebuild the entire house in 24 hours, a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house in 24 hours. But they had all the contractors, everything lined up, so everything was just happening.
Yeah.
The longest thing it took, I think, was the foundation took the longest just because it had to dry to a certain point before they could build it. But once that happened, everything just went up.
Well, yeah, I'm working on a project now that one of my clients needs to sell. It's a large development project for 2,400 units.
Okay.
And he's been developing this land since 2019.
Okay. It's time to get it done, right?
It's a long time. That's a long ass time with all the approval and things like that.
Yeah, but if they had to get it done, they would.
Of yours, because you would get rid of all of the approval, and then they would just make the plans.
Well, they would do like during the pandemic when, you know, Trump pulled the national defense thing out, where he said, you know, because of national defense, this has priority. Mm-hmm. In other words, there are no permits now. There are no laws and there are no regulations. We're going to get this done because it's required for national security. So if China, and this is Randy's opinion, only Randy's opinion, if China were to attack and take Taiwan and take away that chip manufacturing footprint, the United States would say, okay, no problem. 6 months later, we would have our own stuff going, and it would be a slight delay. You know, other than that, it wouldn't be a problem. Yeah, we would just move through it.
Yeah, that's
fair. Huh?
I was thinking about the, I couldn't remember where it was, but it was a Chinese building, so it was a 57-story skyscraper that was built in 19 days. did you hear about this?
No, I didn't.
This was a while back, though.
Wow.
At least the video was like 2015, maybe.
Yeah.
There's a time-lapse video.
Yeah, 2015.
On YouTube, it's pretty wild.
Yeah, it makes
I think there's like 4 or 5 crane at the same time on the building.
It's just working. I mean, but there's no distractions. There's no, it's like, this is going to get done.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no conversation about it. And it becomes a military operation.
Exactly.
We're getting it done.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, so I think, going back to the chip, and it's an issue. I think it's something, you know, they worry about, you know, a disaster, an EMP, electromagnetic pulse, taking everything out. That's because there's chips in everything.
That's kind of the in the Matrix, the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So that's the one. That's kind of the how they killed the robot or something.
Right. They just boom. They
with
it all
the EMP,
out.
And the, I think in the third one.
Yeah, that was it. Third one, and then did you see the fourth one?
No,
no, I haven't seen it either.
Is it good?
No, I don't think so. Not as good as the first three. Obviously,
the first
not.
Three.
I think they just had to finish it up. They just had to finish it up.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah.
So, where do you see supply chain affecting real estate development?
That's a good question. Well,
materials.
Well, there's a big demand for warehouses for distribution now,
right?
So most of the new industrial projects are actually distribution center. Those are the one most in demand.
And what drives the cost on those?
What do you mean?
So you know, supply chain is building these buildings. What is the highest cost for building a warehouse? Cement, steel?
No. It's The I think the first one is most likely bureaucracy, that add because what happened, the bureaucracy, it's adding time,
right?
And then when it takes longer, then the carrying costs are more expensive. Then you have it, then it's longer. It takes longer to have to build the thing and then to rent it out, and everything takes longer.
So the cost of money tends to drive. Because time,
yeah,
everything's just taking
more
time.
And then if you want to talk specifically about what's adding the cost in development, when there's zoning restriction, land development restrictions, things like that, rules again and regulation that restrict the amount of land you can build. So basically, you're putting a cap on the supply. This is one of the major problems in Quebec and Canada because we have this agricultural land law that all of the agricultural land is protected. It's basically impossible to dezone, and then the cities. I think it's only 5% of the land area of the city that is developable.
Okay,
that you can develop.
Wow,
very restricted. And yeah. Then it creates, because Canada, there's only 40 million people that lives in Canada, and it's the second largest country in the world.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then 90% plus of the population lives within 100 kilometers from the U.S. border.
Makes sense. Because it's cold out there, further
it
north.
It is.
It's real cold up there.
It is. And then that adds a lot of the cost. And then also, I know more of the Quebec market. In the Quebec market is the most restricted one though. So then everything is downstream from that. But in the Quebec market, the construction is basically almost nationalized.
Okay.
Because the biggest because government of Quebec account for 25% of GDP in Quebec, which is
makes sense.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot because the Canadian average is. I think it's 16, 17.
Okay.
So Quebec government takes a lot of space, and it does because there's this thing that's called CCQ. So basically, you have to have competency. You have to have your license to work on construction for commercial construction.
Oh wow!
In Quebec,
okay.
Yeah. And then the fucked up thing is that you have to be unionized. There's 26. 26 type of jobs,
mm-hmm.
and then if you're an electrician, you cannot move stuff on the job site because then you're not qualified to move stuff because
right.
Obviously you can't.
You're an electrician.
You're an electrician. You do electricity. Right?
You're not a mover.
You're not a mover.
You're not allowed to move.
Exactly. So there's 26 of them. 26 different type of jobs. Right. So then think about how the fucking like the mess. That can create on a what?
Oh, no
on
doubt.
On a job site.
No
and then
doubt.
Think about all of the restriction that in a day you have to coordinate with 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different guys to do the smallest of jobs.
Right.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
Because then this job implies that a few steps, right? And then you have to have someone that is specialized in all of the fucking steps. because on paper it makes sense.
Right.
But then it's not very efficient.
Not at all.
You need seven people to do what two good guys could do.
Right.
And then so that creates longer time, and then someone is late, and then that delays the job, and then someone can't get on the job job site, then it delays the job further, and then it takes a long time, and that adds to all of the cost.
You're not even talking materials yet.
No,
you're just talking what, bureaucracy, time, people, time. Mm-hmm. Then we talk materials. Well, that's not even a factor as far as
it's not
as
even a factor. This is the because then it's not that it is one, but then it's a factor that you're going to factor in your cost, and then the amount of financing is going to based on cost, right?
Right.
So if because the material is not the biggest thing. It's all of the aggregate,
right?
But mostly regulation, taxes, also incentives too. But then obviously, the money supply dried out now because financing is a little harder. Because in Canada we didn't have a market correction in 2008
when
the bubble popped.
That was another reason I didn't get hired. It was the depression.
Yeah.
2008, 2009. They're like, there's so many other people on the market. We don't need this guy.
He's overqualified.
He costs too much.
That's what happened.
It's like, no.
Unfortunate.
But it's really interesting. You know, even all that bureaucracy and time and people, all that adds up.
Well, one of the big developer in Quebec City a few weeks ago went in the media and he said that just the tax for the municipal level,
mm-hmm.
it was equivalent to $600 on the monthly rent for one apartment.
Really?
Yes.
And what's the benefit of all this bureaucracy? Do the people of Canada, Quebec benefit from this? They obviously have jobs, you know.
Well, what's the benefit of having too much white-collar management in a company? At some point, people are going to need to do the work.
Somebody sooner or later got to pick up a pencil and write something down.
Yes.
But AI can replace all those white-collar workers.
Hopefully.
Yeah, right?
Hopefully we can, because have you followed what's going on in Argentina a little bit or no?
A little bit.
How do you feel about Javier Milei?
That's the new person that was elected, right? And he's bringing more. There seems to be a big move for nationalism right now in many different countries, not just, you know, in Argentina or these other places, because it's bringing this conversation back to, I have to take care of my house first.
Well, yeah.
You know, before I take care of your house, I have to make sure my house is in order. And now things are just, other houses are getting put back in order.
Well, that makes sense too. Like, because if you can't even take care of yourself, how can you have the guts to tell me you're gonna take care of everyone else?
Right.
Like, please, this is not serious.
Yeah.
All of our things are super messy, and we want to handle everything else.
That's where the globalism is collapsing. Everything's, but again, it takes time to bring it back.
It does take time, but it's for me, it's very interesting because I actually studied in economics.
Okay.
Because I figured I might as well know how things work. So I always liked macroeconomics. Microeconomics, it was not something that I enjoyed pretty much. But macro, I kind of liked because then how the money supply works, how the economy works on a global level. And then I remember when I was doing one of my class on macroeconomics in college, then I asked my teacher to, because I was dissatisfied with all of the communists that are some of the economists. So I asked him, I was like, hey, can you recommend me something? Because I had to do a paper on one,
mm-hmm.
and how it was influential and how his work impacted what we have now,
right?
And then so I did it on Frederick Hayek.
Okay.
So he referred him to me, and then I read the book. That was very interesting because then it's the classical liberalism. He was so one of the founder of that movement was Ludwig von Mises. Okay. And then ultimately Adam Smith of the hand of the market or whatever. So basically advocating for less government intervention and to mostly let the free market operate, because then it would theoretically be more efficient, because right. obviously people that are doing business together, they know how much price they're willing to pay for this amount of supply, and then that's kind of the theory that you don't want outside people kind of organizing the transaction if they don't know what's going on and what exactly. entails, because that's ultimately what happens when you try to regulate and when you don't know because it's in economics it's called externalities.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. basically, when you put a regulation in place, then most likely it's going to have some effect that you didn't foresee.
Correct.
And then those are called externalities, and then it's kind of a ripple effect. And then regulation, and then externalities, they're going nuts, and then at some point, you see the economy that collapse, because then you're suffocating everybody.
I think that you see that, you know, not to talk politics, but like Trump's case in New York, where the judge says, you know, these fines, this is what the building's worth, or $18 million when it's worth billions, right?
That's the biggest load of crap I've ever
right?
seen.
Right, but how can that have an effect if the, let's say all these legal appeals don't work, and somebody will say, okay, yeah, it's only worth $18 million. How much of a disastrous effect would that have on the real estate market across the board? That a judge that has no real estate experience, who yeah. kind of goes back to what you're talking about, has no experience, no understanding of the market, says that's what it's worth because I say it's worth that. And it's like, well, who are you? But that's the externalities.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly. And while the externalities, a good example of an externalities on that one, I don't know if you saw in the last few days, but Grant Cardone from Cardone Capital mm-hmm. is right here in Aventura.
Yep.
And then, so they own, I think, 14,000 units or something like that. They're big players.
Mm-hmm.
He canceled all of the acquisition he was about to make in New York.
Yeah, all I heard that. Yeah, I definitely heard that. But that's an impact, right?
Kevin O'Leary, I saw an interview I think last week. He said, "Well, this is true because might as well arrest every real estate entrepreneur ever."
Right.
Because this is how real estate works. You're going to argue with someone how much your building is worth, because at the end of the day, it's just a building,
right?
The way you calculate the value on a commercial building or on a project, you can argue a long time about something that's not there, by the way.
Because
mm-hmm. right. this is what I'm selling, something that's not there.
Right.
And then the developer, he's going to argue that it's worth more, and then the one that's going to have to build it, well, he's going to argue, well, look, I have to pay all of these shit, and then it doesn't make sense, and then there's always going to be a different valuation.
Right.
And at the end of the day, we're going to meet somewhere in the middle, and then hopefully we can make it work.
And that's an agreement between us.
Exactly.
Now, it doesn't matter who this person over here is, and they say, well, you guys, you don't know what you're doing. Your deal's no good. But well, we agreed. We agreed, you know, like, no, it's okay. And like, the other one's like Elon Musk got, you know, sued by his shareholders in Delaware. And the judge said, nope, that doesn't count.
Ooh, yeah.
You know, another judge.
And then all the shareholders, right? they all agreed. And then did you know that the guy that brought in the suit had 9 shares?
Really?
Yes.
That's it.
9 shares.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
The guy owns 9 piece of a company that has billions of piece or whatever the amount,
mm-hmm.
which is not barely 0.1% or 0.001% or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then he can bring in a suit, and then all of a sudden, because the government doesn't like or the judge doesn't like the owner, he's like, oh, you're making way too much money, buddy.
Yeah, I've decided you make too much money.
Yeah.
I've decided that.
I have decided.
Even though you've increased the company's value by trillions, I've decided you don't rate that. It's like, no, that's not how it should work. It should not work that way. But like I said, market should drive that, and make sure that works. How are we doing?
We're good. We have some
more time.
But yeah. No, I agree with you. It's ludicrous. And then especially, and then even with buildings that are there, because the way you calculate the value of a building that is there and has some revenue, then you're gonna have the revenue, your gross revenue, then you take out mm-hmm. the operating expense. This is your NOI. and then the way you come up with the value is going to be a negotiation between the net annualized return on the NOI. So basically, with the NOI, then you can calculate the cap rate, and then you can extrapolate on the value. Say you have $200K of NOI, then if you want to make 5% return on the money that you're investing in the deal, then the $200K is going to represent 5% if you pay the building to $10 million or whatever it is, some sort of
some kind of calculation like that.
Well, it's because I'm not good at math. So
if you AI, I'll do that for you.
$200K divided by 5%. Yeah. See, so if you want to make 5%, you can pay the building $4 million. But then if you want to make 6%, then you need to pay 3.3. So this is what I'm saying. And then so if you have, let's say, with the square footage that we talked earlier,
mm-hmm.
say the square footage brings you $50,000 in revenue more, because then you're not going to have any expense of that on that one. It was just there. So this is called an improvement. So this is how you optimize investments. Mm-hmm. So say you still have the 5%, then shit, it's $5 million that your building is worth.
Yeah,
and then the buyer is gonna.
But then the judge says no. I don't like that.
I don't like what you decided in between us for a transaction that concerned only you two. And the bank got paid too.
And they that was all put out.
Who was defrauded?
They know that nobody. There was somebody said
the loan got paid.
Everyone made money. Everyone was happy, and the judge says, "I don't like your deal because I didn't make money." Oh, okay, judge.
And then the fines we're gonna who's gonna get the fine? Is gonna be the state?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nah, we don't know. You know, hey, watch and learn. That's what I'm doing. Watch and learn. Watch and learn. We'll see how it goes.
Where do you see the market going though for your business? Because then you must see a huge opportunity if only 15% of CEO have their supply chain integrated. No.
What I see is that there's always been a big push for technology. Oracle, PeopleSoft, SAP, these are the systems that they sell for millions of dollars for these companies to manage their supply chain. At the end of the day, people have to type the purchase orders and run these systems. And what I've seen and talked to these people that we train on a regular basis, they just throw the system basically out the window and they use Excel spreadsheets because the systems are too clunky.
It's super convoluted, and it's all Band-Aid in the back end.
Correct.
Okay,
it's
so
a mess.
So what I see is to bring people back to the problem. We need to bring people into the problem so they can better manage the systems. And where AI will help, because most supply chain procurement departments are understaffed and overworked. They work, anywhere, during their high season, which is usually at the end of the fiscal year when they're trying to spend their money. They'll spend, 12, 16-hour days, 7 days a week until all the money's gone.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you mean until all the money's gone?
Well, they have a budget. And so you have the government side or the public sector, and they have a certain amount of budget. Mm-hmm. And if you don't spend it, you don't use it, you lose it. So they'll spend the last month of the fiscal year spending as much money as they can to make sure that it's all spent. Because if they don't spend it, when they do the budget again next year, they won't get that money.
This seems backward.
It does seem backward.
Is it me, or they should be incentivized to save the money instead of fucking waste it?
Private sector, they are incentivized to save the money. Because the more the procurement equals profit, the better they spend their money, the more profit a company makes. It kind of goes back to...
Give them 30%.
Right. Well, they don't. They just give them a bonus, maybe.
Well, because
and that's where I think the advantage or the opportunity.
Well, because look, I'm on the board of a charity in Quebec, and we're talking with people to raise money for us,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to give them 35% of the net before expense that they're raising as a commission.
Right. So the better they spend their money, the more expense, the more commission they'll make.
Yeah.
And that should be, and that's where the people.
Those are incentives.
The people need the skills. Right, and part of the statistics we use when we're talking about training is that when someone is hired by sales spends, I think, $4 billion in training every year. And upwards, when you're first hired as a salesperson, you'll get up to 32 days of training to sell to people who buy, the buyer side, which is supply chain side, and 10 days a year of consistent training every year to make sure you're on top of your game so you can sell more. On the supply chain side, they don't get any training except on-the-job training, and they might get $1,000 each spent on their training each year. So that's the opportunity, is if by telling CEOs that they invest in their people, they'll get more value out of the tools that they're investing in. Cool. And they're investing millions of dollars in tools, but their people don't know how to get the most value from those tools because they don't see the picture from end to end. They don't realize that the price of oil going up, they need to start negotiating quickly to lock in prices before prices start to go up. They don't see that, you know, if a pandemic's coming and all the toilet paper is running out the door, they need to go find some alternate sources for toilet paper to make that work.
They need leaves.
They need, right? They're there. Yeah.
Well, when you know, in the woods, if you don't have anything.
What is that? Well, when we did because we did a canoe trip from Canada to Minnesota.
No way.
Yeah, we did 12 days in the border waters.
Oh, that's cool.
So when you talk about using leaves, like, yeah, that's right.
That's right. Oh, yeah. I grew leaves. Up in the woods. And my father was one of the biggest producers of maple syrup when I was a kid.
Right. You were telling me that. All right. Yeah. And trees and everything.
Literally grew up in the woods outside, yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing, isn't it?
Well, it's
being outside is awesome. Yeah,
very cool. We forgot how cool it was, how good it is for you to be outside.
I think that's where kids need to be raised anyway, outside. Hell. Put them outside, fishing, hunting, sleeping on the ground, being cold and miserable. Builds character.
It's true.
It's true.
It does.
It's true.
It does build character.
39. We could.
But, yeah, I think, you know, there's definitely opportunity on the people side to build better teams. And just, you know, businesses will do better with better trained supply chain professionals.
So do you focus on
the training side of it?
So training side's where my expertise, and I'm adding on the people side this year, where I'm going to – because I have a stream of people coming out of the military service that are looking for jobs, have skills, but they don't know how to articulate those skills.
So what are you going to do is you're going to take those, you're going to train them into training people in companies. And then
training with companies, then approach the company that I have a qualified, certified person here that can do that job. And talking to people at a conference I was at in January, you know, a lady, she was the director of procurement for the city of Austin. She said, I have 10 openings for procurement professionals that I can't fill right now because I don't have enough qualified people. Even though I've got thousands of resumes, I know those resumes are garbage.
What kind of qualification do you need?
Well, what I train is called Certified Professional Supply Management. It's a certification offered by the Institute for Supply Management, which has been around since about 1910. It's been around for a long time.
Okay.
And they established this certification, and it looks at the, you know, end-to-end supply chain.
Is that when they built the railroads in the U.S., the early 1900s, no?
Well, they were building it throughout the late 1800s and early 1900s.
But it was done by 1910.
I think so, yeah.
Maybe that's why they started to train people.
But this, you know, that's where this certification tells civilians that this military person understands civilian lingo enough to do the job and be qualified and do this job. Plus, they have the experience. And, you know, military people are just focused on getting the job done. They don't think about the nonsense and the politics and the other personalities that they have. Like, let's get the job done, and they'll focus on getting it done.
Unbiased, just get it done.
Just get it done. You know, we're going to get this stuff done.
Love that.
And so that's where I think the advantage is. And then with AI coming out in the supply chain career field, is putting people that are trained to manage the AI bots to better. Because we can do AI to do purchase orders, to write contracts, to do the analysis. They can do all that, but you need a person to look at this stuff. Again, say it's right, it's wrong, it's working correctly.
And know what it means and how to use it.
And how to use it.
And what kind of decision you need to take.
Correct.
Based on the data that you analyze.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, some people are going to have to decide.
Yeah. And then the other opportunity is by having a specialized job board, supply chain management .jobs, SCM jobs. It's niched in versus Indeed or ZipRecruiter or Glassdoor, which is kind of like every job's here.
A blanket of.
Anyone and everyone, you know, apply here. This is where you post your job because everyone's here. We're going to say, yeah, everyone's over there, but our supply chain professionals are right here. So you need to post your jobs here. That's where we make the revenue. Post your jobs here.
Oh.
We make money on the revenue, on the training side. We make money on the revenue side as far as posting jobs and having a job board to post jobs. And then we make money on the recruiting side by actually placing people as a recruiter you make 20 to 30% of the first year's salary, and they make anywhere from 50 to 150,000 a year.
Oh, because you're doing a recruiting business.
Recruiting business as well.
Placing people.
Yeah, but in the recruiting business, you got to have candidates, and we're focused on the candidates.
So you're building the candidates, and then you're going to place them.
Correct.
So you're basically you're vertically integrated into.
Right.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. So that's the concept. That's the idea. That's the vision.
How long ago did you started this?
Would we meet?
In December?
December. That was it. That's when I was putting this vision together. Putting all that together. I've been doing training since 2010. I was like, how can I?
You're putting everything together.
So now I'm adding on the training here. Now I'm adding on the people side of it. Because at the end of the day, why does anyone go through training or get certification? It's for a job, for an opportunity. So now we want to expand that out and intend to do that.
Nice.
So, and I own the URLs supply. And it's very niche, you know, and it's a function that every business must have. Right. And there's not enough people qualified in there. So there's a short supply in a high demand field for qualification. That's not very well known. That then gives people.
Yeah, because when you told me you were doing supply chain, I was like, how does that?
Yeah, exactly. That's what most people say. Tell me more. What is supply chain? And it's basically profit of your company. The people that do supply chain and purchase for your company manage your profit. Sales run all day long. They generate revenue. Procurement generates the profit because they manage their expenses. You keep those expenses down, you make more profit. If you're in a government sector, you keep your expenses down, you get to do more stuff. You get to spend more money. So that's kind of the whole opportunity to build that out.
It's very
extremely important.
I think so, yeah. In the military, like I said, they pay for the certification our guys get. So that's the funding side of the training.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And so you work with the military too?
Right now, the Army pays, and the Air Force too, pays for soldiers to get the certification that we train people on. So the whole thing, I was kind of looking at that market. It's like, yeah, we can just do the training, but what are they really getting the training for jobs? How are they getting jobs now?
Finishing connecting the dots.
Connecting the dots all the way through to the company. And then once they're with the company, maintain that support with the veteran so they can assimilate and transition properly and easily.
Yeah, because that must be hard, though, to transition from military life to
civilian. It is, yeah. I can tell you from experience, it's very hard.
How did that go for you?
It was a struggle, looking back at it now, I can say it was a struggle. But at the time, it was the fight I was in. You know, you come out, you've got a certain mentality, you got a certain culture you're involved in, and then you come out, and people are who they are. Like I said, I couldn't get a job. People didn't see my value because I couldn't. I take the blame for it.
You can't articulate. I couldn't articulate it well enough.
But what a military person can do is they can learn. They can show up for the job. If you teach them, you train them, they will do anything. And if you show them loyalty, they'll show you loyalty in return. And that's where, again, the military person struggles is we don't know how to articulate our value. Once we get into that culture, we show up at 6 a.m. and we stay till late, and everyone else is showing up at 8-ish.
So are you during your training, are you teaching presentation and communication as well?
That's the next step. That's the career development pillar of the business. So if you saw my website, it had the training, career development, and then recruiting. And so the training side we have, that's pretty much running. The career development side is starting to build that out. And then once I got the people coming at a consistent base, I got a consistent pool, then I can basically talk to a vet, hey, I want to settle in Dallas. Then I can go to Dallas, find the companies that are hiring supply chain professionals, reach out to them specifically and say, hey, I've got somebody for your position. Would you be interested? Would you want to get into a recruiting contract? I've got the guy for the position you want. You know, do you want to talk? And then they would say, of course, yes.
So one could say you're brokering people.
I am. That's my product is people. Nice. That's exactly right.
Human trafficking.
Nah, in a good way. But that was where you're going. I see that. But
solid
in a good
right
way.
Away.
But yeah, people. And that's and then when I was doing my analysis, I was kind of going through that thought. I was like, what's my product? People are my product.
Yeah.
You got to make sure I have the best people possible for the supply chain career field. And then put them where they need to go. And there's a demand for those kind of people.
Huh. Yes, it's very clever. Yeah. It's going to do very well.
I think. Knock on wood.
Yeah.
I think so, too. Dude, we got to wrap this up.
Okay.
Would
you be willing to do another episode? I feel like we barely scratched
the surface. Oh, hell yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll be back in April for the PBD sales conference.
Hell yeah.
So we can do something back in April. We can set something up.
That was great. I love talking to you.
Yeah, we can have a lot of fun with it. We can go into geopolitics because whole Ukraine, why is Ukraine important?
Well, for Well, farmland. No, it's the
it's farmland. Absolutely,
they're the biggest exporter of basically food
of wheat, and they also make they're one of the biggest exporters of fertilizer for the world.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there's a supply chain challenge there, and then of course we can talk about basketball.
Yeah.
The supply chain of an NBA broadcast. You know, how's it? How does it make a broadcast happen? That you know, you're putting eyeballs out there. We did a whole conversation on that last night. That's what I was talking about.
Oh, wait, okay, can you have a few minutes?
No one's knocking on the door.
Yeah, so we did a conversation last night with my buddy Howard Knapp in Los Angeles. So he gets off at 3:30. I stay up late talking to him. I was like, oh, come on now. So, but we were talking about, you know, the supply chain behind an NBA broadcast. And so we did a whole conversation about what does it take to broadcast an NBA series, right? So two nights a week, there are 16 games going on throughout the country in all these different pro basketball games. And to support each game, you have a production truck with a backup that's connected to fiber optics inside the stadium with, you know, $100,000 cameras all projecting into this one truck who then projects those signals back to a command center in Connecticut, right? And ESPN's putting all this together to produce the show that we all see.
Mm.
And so we're seeing it. We're saying, okay, well, what does it take to make that work? Because if something fails, the broadcast fails, and what's the impact? You got 32 billion people watching a football game, whatever. There's a hurt. There's a pain there. There's dollars there.
Yeah, because you don't
lose their job.
Well, the cost is if you don't deliver on the views, then the advertiser are going to be like, yo, this is not what he said.
I want a refund. And a refund on $7 million for is a lot of money, right? You don't do that.
So then it's important to have a
big We were talking about you got long-term rental agreements with the equipment. You got long-term agreements with the venues. The venues have to stay up to date. They're coming out. Apple come out with those visors. Have you seen those?
Yeah, we've been talking about them.
Right. Well, the NBA has that. Apple and NBA are partnering to produce basketball games with these visors where if you watch them, you're watching five games at one time. Could you imagine that?
Stimulation,
coming into your eyes?
Like, yeah.
But to deliver that.
When I was young, my mom was telling me to not look too close on the TV because it would ruin my eyes.
Well, now you can
Put the eyes.
Now
you're
like
the TV
literally
in, your face.
In front of your face, 1 inch or whatever.
It's like, wow. But still, that's all value. Yeah.
Have you seen people drove with those things too?
Yeah, I don't want to. It's crazy. But yeah, that's kind of, we can talk about that, you know, next time. Kind of like looking at the supply chain of sports. And the reason we're going down the supply chain of sports is because that's what people are interested in. They're interested in sports. And if we show them that there's a supply chain in sports and that you can be a part of that career field, here's the impact. Come look at our training as a career field.
It's a cool application of what you do.
Yeah. It makes it fun and interesting.
Enticing. Yeah, it's something you'd want to go do. You're not feeling like you're sitting like at a
ring
desk.
So it's not just transport then?
It's not transportation. Transportation is one part of the supply chain.
All of the other parts? Is that
you got raw materials, so you got to pull it out of the ground, everything it takes to pull it out of the ground. Then you got to take that raw materials and you got to put it into, you know, steel, into steel pellets or steel bands. Then the steel bands have to go to the manufacturing plant where they melt it down, they turn it into parts. Then those parts have to go to a manufacturing plant where they put it all together. And then once it's all together, then they got to ship it to the distribution center, which then in turn distributes it to the customer. And every step in between.
To the retailer.
Yeah, to the retailer, directly to the customer. And then if there's a reverse supply chain where if they have to return it, then how do you get it all the way back and process it that way? So
cool.
And every bit, every piece of that is a supply chain. Every piece of that has its own supply chain, and everything impacts it. It's like the price of oil again goes up, affects the price of bringing raw materials out of the ground and moving it from this place to this place to this place.
Yeah.
You know, the cost of metal, steel, when they put a 25% tariff on steel during the first Trump administration, immediately impacted the cost of mining because all the equipment was now 25% higher just because somebody said 25% higher.
Yeah.
Right? So all that is supply chain. You know, really, supply chain is everything. You know, nothing, absolutely nothing happens without a supply chain. Even these microphones we're using, somebody built and somebody brought it here.
They had to get here.
It had to get here. Yeah. And then what you do in real estate development, you're building a supply of buildings for warehousing to store stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. And store people, too.
Yeah.
Missing those.
Right.
Five minutes. Where can we find your stuff, Randy?
The best place to go, like I said, is scm.jobs. scm.jobs. That's our website. That's the main website. And then jackquinnsolutions.com is the main site where we talk about the three pillars of our business. And then we have supplychainmanagement.training is our training website. And then the recruiting site, that'll be more on that. So scm.jobs is the main place to find more about us.
That was cool, brother.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
You bet.
Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.